I'm Duncan MacLeod, and this is the Tech Central podcast brought to you today by CECOM. I'm thrilled to be joined again by Byron Clutterbuck, CECOM's CEO, for what I think is going to be a fascinating discussion about some of the big trends affecting the telecommunications industry in Africa, particularly from a data perspective. So, Byron, it's great to have you on the show again. Welcome.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
We all know about the tectonic shift away from voice to data services, and Africa is not excluded from this trend. But I thought as a starting point for our discussion today, if you don't mind, perhaps you could expand a bit on how big data growth, both consumer and business, has been in Africa in recent years and what's still to come according to your projections.
Yeah, I think you have to go back in time a bit to really see how things have changed. But when CECOM went live back in 2009, and we were lit at 80 gigs per second on one of our fiber pairs at that time, that was a radical revolutionary change in the amount of data, international data connectivity that was offered into Africa and the southern and eastern coasts of Africa. And I think since then we've lit the capacity on the cable again and again and again, and now we're at about 1.5 terabytes and we're looking at doubling that capacity around the end of this year. So if you look at just what's happened on the international side, it's been this exponential growth in just the last few years that we've gone from 500 gigs up to 1.5 gig, and now we're doubling that again to 3 terabytes, excuse me. I think that then gets fed into your domestic terrestrial networks and onto consumer and business networks. And I think you're now seeing, when I remember joining CECOM back in 2012 in our office, we had, I think, a 2-meg link, and that was about 40 people working in that office. Here at this office today, I think we have 2 separate 1-gig links, and we're probably going to upgrade that to 10 gig pretty soon. So, I think, just looking at that, you see a radical shift in what that can do for you, not only if you're at your house or you're on your mobile phone, but certainly if you're in the business environment where we're kind of focused on pushing. I think it enables so much more that can be done virtually and allows companies to kind of do more things that are totally digitalized that they couldn't do before. And of course, I think with that comes affordability. And I think we've seen a radical shift in the price points. Although I know that people still complain about data prices being high on their handset, I don't really think you see that so much at the business residence marketplace today.
How much longer is this exponential growth going to continue for?
Yeah, I think certainly what we're seeing is a wave that goes to the key high demand pockets in any market, right? That's the low-hanging fruit, as we'd say. It's the central business districts. It's the high business park, value business parks. It's the finance headquarter offices, et cetera, et cetera. But I think, and it's high-end residential as well. Mm-hmm. But I think what you're seeing as a follow-on to that is that then spreads into tier two towns, secondary office parks, et cetera, et cetera. So while you look at overall fiber penetration in South Africa, still fairly low compared to other parts of the world, you'd think it's very saturated just because if you spend your time in Sandton or in other kind of high-density, high-value areas, you're going to see high penetration, right, and a lot of competition. But I think there's still ground for improvement and the spread of more fiber and more of the access technologies, and we can talk about that later, but off of fiber. And I think, as an example, CECOM's lighting up the FiberCo network that we recently acquired. Mm-hmm. Previously, FiberCo used to just sell fiber. We've taken fibers and lit those up at a terabyte day one. Wow. And we'll be dropping that capacity into towns along the way across South Africa. So all of a sudden now, towns that didn't have this opportunity have this opportunity. And I think that brings a lot of change in types of what kinds of businesses you can now have in, whether it's Bloemfontein or anywhere else that used to be, kind of considered the hinterland. So I think that the wave will continue. Yeah. I think it will change. There's high competition in the densely penetrated areas, but there's more and more need for that connectivity to spread out into the other parts of the country.
But I suppose the volume of data is also growing in those connected areas, the main metros, because the applications that people are using on the internet are becoming more bandwidth hungry, 4K video, video conferencing, all that sort of thing. You must be seeing exponential growth not only in some of the more outlying areas and the opportunities you see there, but actually in amongst existing customers, the growth must be enormous.
Yeah, and that's why I think we've always felt fiber is the key, because I think fiber allows you to scale. Mm. So offices, as I said, today that want 10 meg, tomorrow want 100, next day want a gig, and then 10 gig. If you don't have that capability to easily software upgrade, or to allow that scalability, then you'll be behind the eight ball, so to speak. So I think fiber allows that, which is why we believe fundamentally in fiber. And I think you're absolutely right. There's a huge demand for more and more of that content or applications, virtual compute power. And because of the upgrades on the international connectivity, we've seen the big powerhouses, the cloud hyperscalers, come into South Africa and into East Africa and West Africa and start to put a presence down. And I think that means that more and more connectivity is actually local, although they still feed the cache and update the information and the content that's on the servers that are hosted locally. You're seeing more and more traffic trying to get at that content. And then now compute power is coming as well, as you've seen from Microsoft's announcement and AWS as well. So I think there's more and more of that coming, which then again increases what those high-demand users will use, but also drives the spread of that connectivity requirements out to the outlying areas, so to speak.
So increasingly, people are accessing services and content on the internet from data centers that are located in-country, whereas perhaps in the past, especially in the African context, we'd typically connect over an undersea cable to a server or services, cloud data centers in Europe or the US. That must have resulted in a big change in the type of traffic you're seeing flowing over the CECOM undersea cable system. Increasingly, I'd imagine it's more about you working with big content providers, companies like Microsoft and Google and Amazon, to shift a lot of that data between data centers rather than consumers accessing those data centers remotely from, say, South Africa or another African country.
Yeah, that's very true. I think what you've seen is, because of those, the subsea cables and their capabilities, those providers have come to Africa and placed some of their content and some of their capabilities in Africa, but not all.
Yeah.
So you still see a requirement for connectivity up into Europe and even the United States to get access to things, but certainly the latency issue is a concern. So I think more and more you'll see more of that content, more of those capabilities come onto the continent as the business grows. And most of those, you know, some of them are designed more for consumer, some are more designed for business, but I think you'll see them growing. But and certainly from the CECOM perspective, we have seen our customer base change. It used to be regional and local ISPs, mobile network operators, and other kinds of carriers who were looking to get to Europe to bring that content and capabilities down to Africa, and as a result, because their customers wanted that. But now you're seeing that more and more of that can be hosted locally. So there's a shift in who our customer base is, which is more and more of those content players, those cloud players that want to bring their capabilities to Africa. So they have become bigger customers of ours.
Right. Is this a good news story for CECOM, this trend?
Yeah, I think it's an inevitable trend. Yeah. I think, you know, people talk a lot about the, you know, carriers, the death of carriers, and, you know, what's happening with the telco space. But I think ultimately when you look at, you mentioned earlier about, you know, voice and the shift to data. Previously, the carriers were the AT&Ts or the telecoms or the various mobile network operators. And I think today, when you look at who are the big carriers, and we talk about carriers of data, it is those cloud players. So it's kind of inevitable that they will not only come, but they will be looking to find better, more reliable solutions to get their content and their applications onto the continent. Mm-hmm. That includes, obviously, potentially building some infrastructure themselves, which I think has been talked about quite a bit.
Yeah, I want to dig into that a bit later in the podcast.
Sure.
But I think related to what we've been discussing now, you've identified a trend which you've broadly described as a shift from international to inter-regional telecommunications services. Just please explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, well, I think there's certainly, you know, a general hub and spoke model that's behind all of this, in the sense that, you know, the data centers that need to get built, they're quite difficult to build, highly capital intensive, and you need adequate power, you need the regulations, you need everything. And so they tend to gravitate toward kind of where most of the eyeballs are. So you see the large data centers popping up, obviously, in Johannesburg, in Cape Town, maybe in Nairobi, and to an extent in Nigeria, in Lagos, for example, places like that. And from there, other places want to connect to them. So that starts to drive that kind of regional hub and spoke migration. So in other words, previously, if I was in Mozambique, I would connect up to Europe. Now I can either connect up to Kenya or I can connect down to South Africa to get that content or that application that I want as a small business, for example. So I think that's the change you're kind of seeing. There's definitely a shift that's, and we're seeing that even in our business, where even in that carrier space that I said is kind of not as predominant as it used to be, but they want more now regional connectivity as opposed to getting 10 gig wavelengths up to Europe. It's more about, hey, can I go from Kenya to Johannesburg or Mozambique up to Kenya or up into Nigeria, et cetera. So I think you're starting to see more and more of that kind of traffic flow. And then the countries surrounding South Africa, as an example, would also want to get those applications and that content that sits largely in Johannesburg or Cape Town.
Yeah. So big shift in the way bandwidth is provided on the continent. And this obviously includes the localization of content, storage, compute, applications. What does this all mean for regional service providers and their business models, and what do they need to do to adapt?
Yeah, and I think that's a global trend, no question about it. I think really what you're seeing, and we're facing this, is that the hyperscalers, they build up these big data centers, and they even build up edge data centers where they can, getting closer and closer to the people who need the compute power or the virtual services that they offer. Mm-hmm. But I think the idea that connection from your office and the security that you require at your office and potentially hosting for things that are not in that public cloud at your office, these things are all big considerations for corporates. So there's still a need, I think, for services to be provided, whether you're a consumer or whether you're SME or whether you're a corporate or whether you're a household. That you need a network service provider who's going to provide you reliable, secure, always-on, scalable connectivity as a fundamental. On top of that, I think there's a lot of other services that can be added to that package. So I think that, you know, there's a different role to play. I think what you're seeing is the big hyperscalers are taking over the superhighways because they're the carriers today. So since they're the carriers, it's obvious that they can buy or they can build.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you're seeing more and more is that they will build those superhighways. Now, of course, even in a lot of cities in the United States, you're seeing the likes of Google roll out their, I forgot the name of it, but it's a connection to households and to businesses. And the idea is they'll connect up at a gig. Of course, they have their own business model that drives that, but they're actually getting into service provision, I think, somewhat to stimulate local markets, particularly in the United States, where you have almost monopolistic markets around in pockets of the United States. So I think that, you know, you do see some of that, but I think they're never going to cover the globe. And I think that there's an ecosystem that needs to balance between those hyperscalers and the network service providers, be that a mobile network operator or a fixed or a fiber operator, so to speak.
There's definitely a blurring of the lines between these hyperscale cloud data center providers and telecommunications operators. Where do you think that's going inevitably? Do you think they're going to become kind of the same companies in the future? Do you think that these hyperscalers are actually going to become full-blown telecommunications operators in the future, at least perhaps from a wholesale perspective?
I certainly think from a wholesale perspective, yeah. Because again, you know, the reason submarine cables got built or other infrastructure got built was because you needed to carry certain amounts of traffic. Now, in the old days, that was voice traffic or that was SMS traffic, and then it became internet traffic. You know, but I think when you look at now who's carrying that traffic, it's a different breed of company, right? So on those long haul, and those are the routes that tend to get commoditized, the wholesale routes, so to speak, the subsea routes, who are the carriers? Who's carrying most of the traffic? And you could name those companies probably on two hands. And of course, as a result, those companies are going to want to build that infrastructure, making sure that they can connect up those data centers together. So where does that leave the telcos?
Mm.
I think they certainly have to change. You know, we are a kind of a new age telco, so we're blessed with the fact that we don't have a lot of legacy infrastructure. We don't have any copper or ADSL in the ground. We don't have any old SDH kit hanging about, you know, but that is a reality for a lot of carriers,
right?
So they've got to maximize their investments that they've made and try to catch up and keep up at the same time. And that is a challenge. There's no question about it. But I think certainly there's no question that there's a place for network service providers and managed services providers who can work together with the cloud providers to enable that connectivity and the kind of growth of the ecosystem. I'm not saying it's not a challenge, because I think a lot of the carriers, certainly the incumbent carriers, carry a lot of baggage. There's no question about that.
It's an interesting one. You mentioned telcos working with these global giant cloud providers to provide services to end users. Is there and perhaps for the larger operators, is there an argument to be made that maybe they should actually be trying to compete head-on with the Amazons and Microsofts of the world?
Yeah, I mean, one would say, I think certainly there's no doubt that competition is a good thing. And I think there's certainly concerns that some of these hyperscalers are getting so large and so dominant that they may have a monopolistic power, just like your old incumbent telecommunications providers used to have that monopolistic power. So certainly I think there's that concern. I think that that is a concern where is there enough competition in that space to provide what is best for the consumer. But I think when you step back and not worry so much about maybe telcos and that world, if you're a consumer, if you're a business owner or a business user, what's happening in that revolution, I think, is good all around. I mean, there's concerns about privacy, about use of your data, about all of those things that we all know about. But I think ultimately one would say where we're heading and the services that these providers are offering is something that consumers and businesses want, very much so. Mm-hmm. And I mean, everyone is looking to reduce their costs, to get more efficient, right, and to focus on their own business. Their business might be completely unrelated to the cloud or data network service providing. So I think certainly there's this shift, a revolution, if you will, in the industry. And the industry is looking at itself, what do we do? There's no question about that. And certainly companies who have lots of legacy infrastructure, you know, they can be more in trouble than ones that don't and ones that are more nimble. But I think it's an inevitable change. And I've seen where telecommunications companies say they're going to become a cloud provider or they're going to move, you know. And generally speaking, that's a pretty tough role to shift into.
And they generally end up partnering with the big giants.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's probably, I would say, is the way of the future, is partnering, right? Being able to, if you have a good customer base, you have customers who, you know, you provide a good service, it's a reliable service, of course you can layer on things on top of that service and offer value adds to your customers. But I think that, so I think that's, you know, it's kind of a new world, so to speak. Some people don't like it, but I think it's almost inevitable. And I think it's where the market is going and where all of us are heading and what we want. And when you talk about, you know, 5G and all these things, Internet of Things, we're even going further down that path, right? Mm. And even that would bring in the question of what is the new age operator look like in that environment. Mm-hmm.
What's Ecom's strategy in the space? How do you see the cloud and how do you see your role in it?
Yeah, I mean, Ecom's come from, you know, we're a fairly young company, so we're 10 years old. We've come from very much a fiber optic background. You know, we are the scalable data transmission experts. And so we continue that into our terrestrial efforts. So for the 10 years, we haven't really invested in any large new subsea cable projects. We've been focusing largely on fixing and improving and growing the reach of our terrestrial fiber network. That includes two customer premises as well. So I think our role is really to facilitate this. We are a network service provider. We're not shy about it. That's what we're good at. We only operate over fiber, and we're experts at fiber. And we believe building it right the first time, building it scalable, and building it affordably is key to compete in what's going to be happening over the next 10 years. So I think, you know, the fact that we know we can upgrade at a very low incremental cost, we can always scale with a customer, we have flexibility. You know, as you look at software-defined networks and things that come into play that even allow more flexibility with how you deploy your bandwidth and less rigidity in your network design, these kind of things are something that we are set up to benefit from, I would say. So we're kind of unique in the sense that we're young, we're new, we only have fiber, and we're kind of well aware of what's happened elsewhere in the world and are prepared for this revolution, if you will.
Is there an opportunity? Is it something you're thinking about, building your own data centers, for example, putting in thousands of racks and competing with these cloud guys, or is that not your business?
I mean, that's a massive capital investment, I think. You know, and certainly there are companies that are experts in data center building and management. So you put out a huge amount of capital, and you have a long-term locked customer base of annuity revenue. And a lot of investors love that business model because once you get a customer in, it's unlikely that he's going to move. Right, so it's almost like once you've got this massive data center built, you've got all those racks filled up, it's very difficult for a customer to extricate himself and move to another data center, which is not true when you're providing network services, right? Customers can swap very easily, right? Or even cloud services, also customers can swap pretty easily. So the question is, you know, can you continue to provide value add in that space to your customers and keep them there? I think data centers, you know, I think what you're seeing really in data centers is a growth of global platforms of data centers. I mean, there's the data centers built by the cloud players for their specific use, and then there's the data centers that are kind of almost the interconnection hubs of the world. And these are becoming more and more global platforms where they're owned by one company, which allows that seamless interconnection globally. Mm. As you're, if you're a multinational bank, for example, going around the world, you know you work with company A in their data centers, you're going to get the same spec. You want to order cross connects, you can do it online. You know, you can roll out very easily and quickly. So I think there's that aspect of data centers too, and I think that's why you're seeing such consolidation in the data center space, right? And you'll continue to see that even in Africa, right? Because there are not many, one would say, carrier-neutral data centers yet in Africa.
Mm. I was chatting to someone who works in a data center recently. I forget who it was, but he said that building data centers, managing data centers is actually more akin to the property management industry than it is to the technology industry. Because you're creating space, you're renting it out. There's sophisticated technology going in there, but at the end of the day, you're basically managing a piece of property.
You're managing a piece of property, mm-hmm. Yeah. And most of them, that's why they're real estate investment trusts, right? That's the new model. Right? So, and again, you know, if you can find big funding, build a big building, you know, set it all up, and you charge rent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't sell the house, you rent the house.
Mm-hmm.
So that model is obviously very attractive to investors, as you can see from some of the multiples that are paid for those kind of businesses, right?
Yeah.
Because they believe that you've got a locked customer base, right?
Mm. So where do you see these? I mean, we've seen a lot of investment here in South Africa. I think there's been some investment in Kenya as well by these global cloud providers and regional and local internet service providers and cloud operators. Where do you see the investment in this space happening across the continent going forward? Do you think there's going to be a lot more investment in West Africa, perhaps some more in East Africa?
Yeah, I mean, I think right now what you're seeing is kind of three main hubs, right? I would say one is East Africa, largely it's Kenya. You're seeing West Africa, largely Nigeria, and you're seeing South Africa. So, I mean, I think, you know, if you look around the world, what tends to happen, and this happened, I was in Asia for many years, and it happened in Asia. Of course, you always go to the key metropolitan hubs. You go to Hong Kong, you go to Singapore, right? And then the next foray would be Bangkok and Jakarta and your tier two. You know, so I think you'll see that same rollout. So you'll see expansion within certain markets, and I think certainly South Africa, being the large economy that it is, and the number of corporates that are here, and hopefully we can get a few things sorted out in this economy, but I think that you'll probably see more we call edge data centers. So you've got your big data centers in the key metropolitan city centers, and then you'll have smaller data centers that will serve more local markets over time. And I think that will happen as well, like people looking at Maputo, people looking at Dar es Salaam, you know, do you need data centers there? How big? You know, what scale? But I think those will be probably smaller scale data centers that will probably be built more to serve that local market. What's needed that needs to be absolutely close to where customers are and eyeballs are? You know, what do you put there?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not going to be everything. Just like even the data centers that are coming here today and what's happening with some of those big players, they're not putting everything here,
mm-hmm.
right? They're putting a limited set of what they offer globally here. And they'll migrate more and more over time as the market picks up.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you'll see both growth of the key hubs, if you will, and then you'll also see expansion of those edge data centers going out to where the
what sort of applications are. Will go into those edge data centers?
I think everything from, you know, data storage for the finance industry. I mean, it's all quite specific to your customers.
So regulatory stuff particularly.
Could be regulatory. Mm. Could be just speed of access, you know, depending on the applications, things like that. So it becomes quite specific when you know, if you look at a CBD, you'd have large data centers kind of around. I'm talking about maybe a U.S. city or a European city. And then you'd have smaller edge data centers potentially right in the CBD as an example.
Mm.
So you provide... You begin to kind of take on the business that banks may used to have that in their basement.
Yes.
You know, and you convince them to migrate now to a data center. They may say, well, I don't want it so far away. So I'm going to have some of it close. And then they kind of look at, okay, what applications do you need close by? And what could be longer latency further away?
Mm.
And then, of course, you have your data storage regulations that you have to be aware of, too.
Yeah.
Can it be in another country? That could be an issue.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's explore edge computing in a little more detail, because I think it's a hot topic at the moment, especially because there's a growing view that as 5G mobile begins to take off, that a lot of computational stuff isn't in fact going to happen in these large global data centers. It's going to happen very close to the end user. Mm-hmm. Some of the applications I've heard spoken about in this context include things like self-driving cars, which need very low latency. You need to do processing very close to where you're actually driving. You can't have your signal connect to a data center in New York and come all the way back, because in that amount of time, something terrible could have happened. There is a suggestion that edge computing could put the advantage back in the telecoms operators' courts and away from the global cloud giants, and that that maybe this is actually a huge opportunity for regional telcos to start to build a meaningful cloud business around edge computing. What are your views on this, and how do you think it's going to impact the industry broadly?
Yeah, I do think that that will be the trend. In other words, whether it's self-driving cars or other applications that I mentioned, certainly I think, you know, in the old days we talk about latency. It would be from, you know, getting from Johannesburg to New York or getting to Ireland. And today we might talk about it from, you know, Cape Town to Johannesburg. So I think, you know, the idea of what is, you know, acceptable latency and what kind of application is it being used for is changing. And I think all things being equal, being closer would be better, right? And having that compute power nearby. I think that has held in the computer industry, where people used to think, oh, someday everyone will be sitting at a desk and you'll have a dumb terminal. And that really hasn't happened. If anything, actually, we've got more compute power on our mobile phones now that we put in our pockets, you know, than we had on our desktop 10 years ago. But I think certainly that, you know, I'm not sure about self-driving cars, but certainly the Internet of Things, I think there is this idea that there will be certainly in high-density, high-value business districts or even high-value residential districts, there will be this idea that everything can be connected at a very high speed and will not have latency issues. So that compute power, that virtual support, whatever it is that is required will be nearby. And you won't have issues of, you know, certainly network reliability will be very important, because that example you used, latency is one issue, but if the network were to go down, that would be a bigger, even probably a bigger issue. So the idea of multiple support centers that are spread out and fully diverse and connected over diverse networks is very important. So that meshing of networks. And I think that does present an opportunity for local ISPs and people who are playing in that space to provide that benefit. And it may be even that it's a combination, because when you start to operate a lot of these things, most corporates, as an example, don't put all their eggs in one basket. So they'll have a main provider, but they'll have a secondary provider. So I think the idea that you could work over multiple networks to give you added resiliency and making sure that connectivity is very close, the application processing power is very close, is very important.
That resiliency or redundancy is obviously going to require more networks and certainly more fiber infrastructure to connect everything together. How is CECOM poised to take advantage of that? I know you made the Fiberco acquisition recently. You've made some other investments. But I imagine that as we head into this 5G world in particular, that a lot more terrestrial infrastructure is going to be needed.
Yeah, and I think it's got to be the right kind of terrestrial infrastructure. In other words, it needs to be designed, I think, to be scalable and affordable, right? And it needs to be fully diverse. So I think when you see today with more and more customers, and even as we design our networks, people are much more aware of the need for resiliency and full resiliency. So people look, and if they see fiber that goes into a building in the same conduit, they will not accept that. If they see fiber that crosses on a street, unacceptable. So, you know, it's become much more heightened awareness because reliability is so important. So I think service providers have to make sure that they design their networks that way. So CECOM, I think that's, you know, we were originally a single leg. And when we were down, the African Internet was down, mainly because we were the African Internet at that time. Right? But, you know, of course, as WAX came online and other cable systems came online, we got capacity on those cable systems so that we could offer a meshed backbone. But that's just the backbone. And I would say, even if you look at the international backbone, there probably is not what I would consider adequate resiliency in the network, just from a continental perspective. You know, if you look between Europe and the United States, there are probably 20 fiber paths at least between Europe and the United States, all separate, all linear, all carrying huge amounts of traffic. One goes down, there's absolutely no impact. Two goes down, there's no impact. So you'd have to have catastrophic events that would even have any impact whatsoever on that. And I think in South Africa, when you look at South Africa, you're really connected by three high-speed cables.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you know, you could add SAT-3 in there, a little bit of capacity there, but it's going to be soon well outdated. So you really need more resiliency. Most network designers would say you want to have a five-way mesh. So I think when we look at building terrestrial networks, we certainly look at fully linear diverse paths. We build them. We then try to swap and use another provider's other path, and it's good for them, it's good for us. So we try to build in as much resiliency at the lowest possible cost that we can, so that we have, as many linear paths, as many linear mesh paths as we can, carrying large amounts of capacity. So if one goes down, the other two can cope. I think that's very different than the old ring-protected networks that were just one ring. You've got to have meshing. Mm-hmm. So I think when we build networks in the future, that's what it's going to be all about. Linear, fully diverse, equipment diversity, fiber diversity, route diversity.
In terms of the densification of the terrestrial fiber network in South Africa, do you see opportunities for further acquisitions by CECOM? Do you have plans to do your own terrestrial builds between cities? What is your thinking?
Yeah, I don't think we would do, I think most of the things that would be more commoditized, so that would include submarine cable mm-hmm. builds, that would probably include long-haul builds as well. I think most of those are better served by doing joint investments, share infrastructure backbone. This is pretty common in the industry, whether you're a mobile network operator or anybody else, share the infrastructure costs on those things that are kind of commoditized, if you will. They're your superhighway. So I think when we look at, we look around, we think, well, FiberCo was a good acquisition because I think there was a market need there for that scalable fiber network and to have it be utilized the way that CECOM will drive it. We will then utilize that to get other paths to build resiliency in the network. So our focus will be more on metro fiber connectivity. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there's not that many companies, but I think you can find isolated pockets where companies have built up a small niche market. They have enough business customers in an area that we can just plug into the CECOM backbone, so to speak, and drive network connectivity to greater use of that customer base. So I think we'll be looking more for kind of companies that have enterprise customer base, they have network, they have fiber in the ground that goes to corporate offices or metro areas that we can utilize and plug into our backbone.
Byron, before we wrap, let's talk about the new undersea cables that are coming. Sure. There's been quite a lot of speculation around this in the recent past. We've had the confirmation from Google that they are building the Equiano cable. I think they've now commissioned a subsea survey with a view to begin construction on that project. That's going to link South Africa with Portugal, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And of course, Facebook is rumored to be involved with various telecommunications operators in building some sort of consortium to encircle Africa in a cable system called Simba East and Simba West. We already, of course, have WACS on the East Coast. There's the ACE system, which I think now lands in Cape Town, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it landed some time ago. It's just not active and live yet.
Oh, it's not live yet. Yeah. Okay. Plus various others, of course. I guess the first question is, do we need all this additional capacity? Is there a business case for it?
Yeah, I think the fundamentals, when you look at, as I said, East Coast, you really have two cables. You have the Easy Cable and you have the CECOM cable. On the West Coast, you really have WACS. And I'm not discounting ACE or SAT-3, but SAT-3 is an older cable, went live in 2002.
Yeah.
And I think it's reached its maximum capacity level at about 800, 900 gigs. ACE is new, but ACE is very much a festoon cable. So in other words, it lands with a lot of segments in a lot of countries up the West Coast. So for a high-speed superhighway from South Africa to Europe, ACE is not really designed for that, so to speak.
So there's no direct link on ACE all the way out?
There's not really express fiber pairs.
Does it actually land and then go out?
It lands and goes out. So when you have a lot of segments on a cable, of course, that means you're putting more equipment in, and you have latency, and you have more risk of outages, because most cable outages happen as you get into the shoreline. So ACE will have its role to play, but I don't see it being a revolutionary event when it goes RFS in South Africa. But certainly connectivity up the African West Coast, and as that interregional traffic increases, yes, you will probably see ACE being used. But I think what Google is planning is more of a superhighway. Right? So the idea is very much a direct link from Portugal to South Africa. It will have some BUs, but those BUs will be kind of flexible, multi-directional BUs. But
BU being a branching unit?
A branching unit, sorry. So it will be able to extend, and then a plan, I believe, is for them to extend in some other markets as well. But I think the core focus is to build that superhighway. And I think that's, Google is, my understanding, is driving that. They're, looking to work with partners on that. But I think that your question is there a need? for these cables? I think the answer is yes, because as I said, I can't see a continent of 1.3 billion people and all the businesses and economic growth we're forecasting to survive with cable systems that are 10 years old and no one adding any cable systems. So that's just, you know, and the fact that if one or two goes down, you're highly at risk of being, you know, the dark continent once again. Things will be cut off. So I think there's definitely a need for diversity, right? And I think there's also a definite need for affordability. So when I look at those things, I think, yes, there's a need for a cable. The thing that's a little surprising about these new planned cables is the number of fiber pairs they're putting in. Mm-hmm. Because I think if you wanted to add diversity, one would say, well, build two separate cables, you know, and maybe make them six or eight fiber pairs each as opposed to building one.
Is it significantly more expensive to add fiber pairs?
No, it's not really significantly more expensive. So that's why it's you know, and a lot of times people build cable systems. I myself have been in that spot where you've built it and you wished you had a couple more fiber pairs. So there's always, you know, the incremental cost versus the risk of not having those fiber pairs, I think, pushes people to say, let's build with more fiber pairs. But even again, if you have, you know, imagine in a day where Equiano is the only cable on the West Coast and WAX has been retired and SAT-3 is long retired, you're going to have to build another cable, because even though there's probably adequate capacity on that 12 fiber pair system or whatever they end up building, you need diversity. So I think it's that balance between, you know, the speed and the affordability, because I think building multiple fiber pairs on superhighway routes drives affordability, right? Because you've the infrastructure cost is quite large, but adding an incremental fiber pair or two fiber pairs or four fiber pairs is relatively minor, right? The approval process, the construction of a landing station, the environmental approvals, the laying of the cable, the ships, all these things, the cost really doesn't matter whether it's a two fiber pair or a six fiber pair or a 12 fiber pair system. Just a small incremental cost to the manufacturer to build that system. And then, of course, the electronics that go on it. You do have to light those fiber pairs and power them and all that operating cost that goes with it. So I think there's definitely a need. You know, the business case, I think, for telcos will be more of a challenge because, as I said, who are the global carriers of the world today? It's the Googles, it's the Facebooks, it's the other players in that space. So if they're building their own cables, then who are you going to sell to? Which will be the challenge. So I think, having said that, I think there's the need for resiliency. There's the need for private data networks. There's the need for government data networks that are divorced or separate from what those big cloud players do. So I think there's still a market that would say there's still private corporate networks. There's other things that will not be on the public cloud or not be on those players' platforms. And there's definitely a service requirement that needs to be managed for those kind of customers. And I think the idea of those players today, if you looked around, could the telcos, the so-called carriers of today, could they afford to build these cables by themselves? And I think the answer is, well, we've been sitting since 2012 and no new cable has been built. A lot have been talked about. None have been built. Because I think there's that financial risk that says, is there a business case? But, you know, if it's driven by somebody who has the funding and can build it and they get their benefit, we get our benefit, then I think that's kind of a healthy relationship.
Because the revenue model, the business model for these big internet giants, I guess, is a little different to the telcos. They're doing this for different reasons. A
totally different reason, right? Mm. Their revenue comes from advertising or from, you know, cloud customers, and the telcos are a network service provider. Mm. So, you know, when you look at, you know, data prices today, particularly international data prices, if you said how much is a 10 gig going to cost you, and you did that math and you said, well, gosh, how many 10 gigs would I have to sell to justify a fiber pair investment in one of those cables? That would be a little bit of a scary proposition, I think. Yeah.
The irony is that historically it's the telecommunications operators that have sold this capacity to the cloud providers. And now
they still do. I mean, it's certainly around the globe because they don't own everything. I mean, they're only building on selected routes. So.
But we could conceivably see telecommunications carriers in Africa now buying capacity from Google.
Yeah, and I think Facebook has announced that they are setting up their own wholesale division. I don't know, Google hasn't done that, but Facebook has. So they will actually sell wholesale, which is kind of interesting when I saw that. But again, I think, you know, if you look at it, you step back as a consumer or a business user, you'd say, well, wait a minute, this frees up investment for the telcos, the MNOs and the regional guys to invest in the domestic infrastructure, which, you know, in Africa is certainly needed. And as a matter of fact, it's needed in the United States and it's needed in a lot of other places. So I think it says, okay, your backbone is built. You're not going to make money on international connectivity anymore. Those days are kind of over. But there's still a huge need for building up terrestrial infrastructure, mm-hmm. data centers, connectivity to households, connectivity to businesses. So I think that's really, you know, where the future is for a network service provider, right? There's no point to go and try and, I think, to, you know, think that you're going to make money in the subsea connectivity game at a wholesale level anymore. I would think that would be the challenge.
So there's a business case for building a superhighway, as you termed it, along the west coast between South Africa and Europe. Is there a pressing need to do the same on the east coast, or is that route well served at the moment?
Yeah, I think the challenge on the east coast is more, I don't want to say political, but geographical, perhaps, mm-hmm. Because anything that goes up the east coast. So you've got Easy and you've got Seacom, and also from Kenya north you've got Teams, and there's a cable coming down from Djibouti called Dare that is under construction as mm-hmm. well. So you could say the east coast at least has those two cables going into South Africa. You know, they have diversity, but they're not fully diverse. One would look at their spacing and say, you know, you could land them a little further apart or have, you know, but largely they're diverse cable systems. And they have adequate capacity, let's say, for the next 3 to 5 years, depending on really the demand. But when you think about that it takes 3 years to build a cable system, then you start to say, well, it kind of makes sense. So I think, yes, there's a need for a cable on the East Coast, you know, the need, if you start today, it's still not going to happen for at least 2 to 3 years. Mm-hmm. But I think the challenge on the East Coast, unfortunately, is that almost all cables to get into the Mediterranean to get to Europe have to go across Egypt. Mm-hmm. And I think just from a diversity perspective and an operating perspective, right, that is a challenge because no other operator except Telecom Egypt can operate across Egypt. So you're kind of, again, getting to a point where you're adding diversity on the subsea side, but once you land in Egypt and go across Egypt, you're relying on one operator, which is a little bit of one operator risk. And the second is you're all geographically routed across Egypt, one country. And those routes are not as diverse as you'd probably like. So I think, you know, that was the challenge when we looked at the East Coast is how do you get diversity? How do you get adequate diversity?
Is there another route you could take?
Well, I guess it, you know, depends on applications. We see that, you know, the Seacom cable has a lot of capacity from Kenya going south, mm-hmm. just because of the distances are much shorter. We land in from Mombasa to Dar, Dar to Maputo, Maputo down into Mtenzini. And then we can go now across South Africa with our own fiber that we acquired at Fiberco. So I think you can see more and more standard traffic, household use internet, things like that, that traffic actually being routed around the West Coast. Mm-hmm. So when you think about it that way, yes, you add some latency, but what you make up for in affordability and reliability, I think are quite important. So I think you'll see certain applications maybe need to, you know, get that extra at 20 millisecond, 30 milliseconds less from Nairobi up to Europe. But a lot of applications, they don't need that. Mm-hmm. And I think that you could even see connectivity going around Africa, which is something we believe in. So you could we do that today. You know, the most obvious outages and the ones that were reported on in our early days at Seacom were always in the Mediterranean, the Red Sea, or across Egypt.
Mm. Yes.
Right?
Ships anchors often.
Yeah. Mm. Nothing ever happened, you know, in the deep waters around Africa or the coastlines of Africa. Mm. It was always in that area. So I think that's a high-risk area. Yeah. And multiple cables were taken down even in the Mediterranean, as an example, or in the Red Sea.
Yeah.
Because they're all kind of congesting into one
narrow,
in a very narrow route. Mm-hmm. On the West Coast, you're largely in deep water, and particularly what the Equiano cable, as an example, is being designed for that. Mm-hmm. So it goes offshore and has BUs going in, but it's in deep water. Mm. That makes it actually lower cost to construct, but it also means it's more reliable, safer. Mm. Nothing ever happens to a cable in deep water unless there's an underwater earthquake or something like that, which does happen, but quite rare. Mm.
So what are your plans then to work with these new cable systems? Do you see a point in the future where Seacom builds another cable system like it did the Seacom cable along the East Coast by itself, or are you much more likely to work with partners in investing in new cable infrastructure, or are you happy just to let the Googles of the world get on with the project and you simply buy capacity from them?
Yeah, I think we look at it maybe just from a different perspective. Certainly when Seacom was built, the idea was there's a massive demand for a certain type of service. And so the investors in Seacom had the foresight to say, hey, this is a huge opportunity, and it brings a great benefit to Africa, so let's build the Seacom cable system. No one else was building, and then, of course, a few other cables did get built, but Seacom was the only private cable that really allowed open access. So I think, you know, when we look at the new builds, I think we look at it more from, okay, what do our customers require? What do we need to deliver for our customers? And how can we do that in the most cost-efficient manner? So I think working with partners who are building other cable systems, building that superhighway infrastructure, as I said, mobile network operators cooperate on long-haul builds, on towers, you know, other providers, we swap fibers on different routes with other providers. So the idea of working with, you know, Facebook and Google or other providers who are becoming data carriers makes total sense in my mind. Mm. I mean, I think we need to look at what our customer base requires and how can we get that at the best price, the best solution for our customers. So if it's working with Google, if it's working with Facebook or any others who are building, we will joint build. I think globally you see less and less solo private builds of subsea cable infrastructure. I just think that it's, you know, people are, unless it's a market that is completely isolated and not served and somebody has a very strong potential monopoly position in that marketplace, you might see someone building a cable on their own.
There but can't be too many of those left.
You don't see too many of them, right? Mm. And a lot of them look for key anchor customers and fiber pair sales and all these things, and they become almost a joint cable project even before they get off the ground. So I think that those days, you know, having said that, are there certain festoon segments that could go to certain markets mm-hmm. or that could add resiliency between certain countries? I think certainly that can happen. And I think that could be something we look at. But I think, you know, to be honest, I think we'd focus rather the international connectivity will be on board with those players because I think we need that to serve our customers, to give them added diversity, give them better quality, better speed. And then we'll also focus on the terrestrial builds that deliver that to their doorstep. So I think it's kind of, you know, the other item becomes more, I want to say, commoditized, but it just becomes a need that we have, and if it's getting built, then we'll participate. But I think we have to focus on serving our customers and providing them the value add that they would get from that.
Byron, it's always a pleasure to chat to you. Byron Clatterbuck is CEO of Seacom. Thanks, as always, for making the time.
Thanks. Pleasure.